Thank you all. Ann Folk asked me to remind you all that you just ate a Parker House roll. So welcome to Boston. I really do want to say how delighted we are to have you in the city. We promised you something that was non-traditional and extraordinary, and I hope we'll deliver on that. Very importantly, I want to thank the staff of Grantmakers in the Arts. No, it's true. They're so wonderful that most of them are eating in the overflow room, but I actually want to thank them by name, so when you see them around, you can say thank you. Julie Sponsler, Melinda Sneed, Shania Patterson, Gail Piper, our own Ann Folk, an extraordinary ED, and last but not least, Tom, you have to stand up. I've never seen anybody work this hard. So we're very glad that you're here, and we hope you enjoy being with one another and learning together, and that we leave here with many memorable experiences. I'd like to ask the members of the Indigenous Resource Network to come up. They have a presentation to make.
Nyawe Askanu, I am glad to see that you are all well. I am Tanya Ganella Frischner, Board of Directors of the Seventh Generation Fund, and also a citizen of the Onondaga Nation. It is my pleasure to be asked to make this presentation to the Penobscot singers and drum, and also to our speaker from this territory, our great friend, Teresa Secord, from the Penobscot Nation. My first order of business, of course, is to thank the traditional people of this territory for allowing us the privilege of being on their territory. So thank you very much to our Indigenous brothers and sisters. On behalf of Grantmakers in the Arts, the Indigenous Resource Network, First Peoples Fund, and the Seventh Generation Fund, we have this small token of our gratitude from the Indigenous peoples of California. They put together sacred tobacco and medicine from their territory, and it is my pleasure to give it to our friend Teresa Secord.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Jonathan Freeman. I'm also with the Seventh Generation Fund, and very honored to be up here today to, in our way, to make payment, to acknowledge, to give thanks for our speaker and for the drum that's been here, that's coming to sing and to share with us here shortly. In our way, we bring things, tobacco, shells. And so today I'd like to present this little bit of tobacco that we at home in Northern California, that we're bringing back our old ways, and one of it is to grow our own tobacco. So this is for the drum and the singers, with payment and thank you.
Hello, everyone. I'm Rebecca Blunk, Executive Director of the New England Foundation for the Arts, and I'd like to add my welcome not only to Boston but to New England. It's really great to have all of you here. And I also want to acknowledge the Wampanoag people, the original stewards of the land on which we're gathered, and Ramona Peters, who's from the Bear Clan of the Mashpee Wampanoag people, is here with us. She's a potter. She's Ramona, please stand up. And also, we are delighted to have with us, I'd like to recognize Charlene Jones, who's the tribal counselor from the Mashinteca Pequot Tribal Nation. Charlene Jones. So I get to introduce Teresa Secord and also our singers. And so what I'd like to do is just first say I'm delighted to have been working very closely with Teresa, and the Maine Indian Basket Makers Alliance, also known as MIBA, over the last couple of years. And I can really easily say that we're extremely grateful to have the resources and leadership from the Ford Foundation that's greatly enhanced our collaborative work together for the establishment of a Native Arts program here in New England at NEFA. And NEFA is very proud, my organization is very proud to be a part of a newly organized cohort named the Illumination Building Capacity for the Future of Native Arts. And again, thank you for that opportunity. And I just wanted to mention this because I think all this work with Teresa and MIBA and the indigenous people that I've gotten to know in this process has really been a gift to me of a certain awakening in a way, and along with the challenge that really has been an amazing boost to my professional sort of life and personal life. So again, thank you. Now to tell you about Teresa. Teresa Secord, our speaker today, is founder and executive director of the Maine Indian Basket Makers Alliance. Again, the acronym is MIBA. It's got going back in 1993. In that year, the average age of basket making for the Wabanaki people, the four tribes that are federally recognized that comprise the Wabanaki people, Maliseet, Mi'kmaq, Passamaquoddy, and Penobscot, the average age for basket making was 63. And through outreach, MIBA's work, education, basket making apprenticeships to many younger members of the tribes, MIBA has brought down the average age to 43. Talk about being able to count your successes. Teresa's formal education includes a bachelor's degree in geology from the University of Southern Maine, and a master's degree from the University of Wisconsin in economic geology. And she was the staff geologist for her tribe, the Penobscot tribe, for 12 years. She's also very active as a basket maker herself, which you'll learn about if you don't already know, and managing even with her packed schedule, which includes parenting to two teenage boys, to show and work at markets and in galleries across the United States. And Teresa's received many awards and much recognition, not enough yet, but for her work as both an artist and a cultural leader. As a couple of examples, in 2003, she became the first U.S. citizen to receive the Prize for Women's Creativity in Rural Life from the United Nations Women's World Summit Foundation in Geneva, Switzerland. And that was for her efforts to sustain tribal basketry. And then in her home state of Maine, she's received the Maine Governor's Award for Arts and Heritage Tourism. Teresa has also served on the Maine Arts Commission. So the Maine Arts Commission is one of my organization's state arts agency partners. And in 2004, Teresa was elected to the board of New England Foundation for the Arts, NEFA, my organization. So I want to publicly express my deep appreciation for Teresa's passion, character, and accomplishments as a community leader and as an artist of New England. And I thank her for accepting our invitation to be here today. But first, before Teresa speaks, it is my pleasure to introduce an appropriate sort of lead-in to Teresa's talk. I'm presenting to you the Bunawabskek singers, comprised of Ron Baer, Rob Dana, John Neptune, and Nick Baer, who are they've traveled down here from Old Town, Maine, to be with us. The group travels and performs widely, sometimes with other singers that comprise their group. Their second CD recording is coming out next month, and they probably have brought a few CDs with them, in case you're interested. And they'll be singing in the Penobscot, Passamaquoddy, and Maliseet language. So I present the Bunawabskek singers.
Thank you. thank you to my brothers, the Benawebskeg Singers, for coming here from Maine. I was joking with them earlier and saying put it up a little. They've actually followed me throughout the work of the Maine Indian Basket Makers Alliance through Maine and a lot of our events, so it's a great honor that they came to help us open the proceeding in a good way. Can you hear me now? You have to go. Yeah, actually, Nick just pointed out that his wife is expecting a baby any minute, so they have to go. Well, congratulations. I want to start by saying a few words in our tribal language. So I hope you can hear me now. Our language is, I think, maybe the last spoken indigenous language in New England. And actually, those guys are some of the only ones who will probably understand me. Kwe Danagakia, Nidali Gakums, Skijina Wadaway Walgan, Nidali Wisnil, Dele Secord, Banawebskewi, Nagi, Abuzanu Dakad, Nilun, Wabanu Giweag, Buwals I Kwelpa, Gumaj Nolas Weltum, Iliud Ihi, Williwini. I greeted you in Maliseet Passamaquoddy because I think it's really important to share our words here. Ronnie's mother is my teacher, and she's also my cousin. She's 59 years old. She's one of the last speakers of our language in Maine. I told you that I'm learning our language and that I'm a Penobscot basket maker. I related that we are the people of the Dawn, the Wabanaki, the first people, and that I bring greetings. I said that I'm very grateful for this opportunity to speak. I do want to thank the Indigenous Peoples Network and Seventh Generation Fund for the presentation, New England Foundation for the Arts, and my friends at the Ford Foundation for entrusting me with this message today. Williwani to the representative on the Wampanoag Nation, and to my brothers, of course, the Banawebskeg Singers. It's my honor now to share a little history, basketry, and provide some insight into the Native arts world as I see it, and also through the lens of some of my colleagues and their good works. I want to start by reading to you from what could be the first recorded account of the creative economy in New England. In 1524, Giovanni di Varzano sailed from Italy to the east coast of North America. This account speaks about meeting who we now know to be the Narragansetts of Rhode Island and the Penobscots of Maine. Before entering the bay, Narragansett Bay, we saw 20 small boats full of people who came about our ship, uttering many cries of astonishment. Among them were two kings, more beautiful in form and stature than can be possibly described. This is the finest looking tribe and the handsomest in their costumes that we have found in our voyage, their expression mild and pleasant. He goes on to describe the beauty of the Narragansett's clothing, their personal ornamentation, arrows, and even their canoes. He speaks about their willingness to trade. Then to the north. The shore stretched to the east to a more elevated country full of thick woods. The people were entirely different from the others we had seen. These were so rude and barbarous that we were unable to hold communication with them. They clothed themselves in the skins of bears, lynxes, and seals. If we wished to traffic with them, they came to the shore and stood upon the rocks, lowering, and I emphasize, baskets, by a cord to our boats, whatever they had to barter, continually crying out to us not to come nearer, and instantly demanding that which was to be given in return, knives, fish hooks, and sharpened steel. No regard was paid to our courtesies, and when we had nothing left to exchange with them, the men at our departure made the most brutal signs of disdain and contempt possible. In today's language, the Wabanakis of Maine mooned Verrazano and his men. This is the state of the creative economy in 1524. Were Verrazano to sail to Maine today, he might meet David Moses Bridges, a Passamaquoddy birch bark artist. He's a 2005 Community Spirit Award recipient, so honored by the First Peoples Fund last year for his artistry and his activism in the ongoing fight against a large liquefied natural gas project on his reservation in eastern Maine. This photo is by artist Hulea Tsinigini. And last month, David was also awarded a Maine Arts Commission Traditional Arts Fellowship. The 18-foot ocean-going canoe that he's paddling was commissioned by the renowned painter Andrew Wyeth, who also owns a home on an island in Maine. I think he owns the whole island, doesn't he? Next. The Maine Indian Basket Makers Alliance formed, as Rebecca stated, in 1993, when we realized there were fewer than a dozen basket makers younger than the age of 50 in the four tribes. Ours is a story of self-determination, as we have steadily lowered the average age of basket makers, effectively saving the ash and sweetgrass weaving traditions for the time being. Our creation is based in the ash, Wiccup. As it is said that Gluskabe, our culture hero, shot an arrow into the tree, and from the tree came this first people singing and dancing. I want to let you know that those woven ash and sweetgrass bookmarks on your tables started out as a tree in the North Maine woods and as grass at the sweetgrass at the coast of Maine. Those are gifts to you from the Maine Indian Basket Makers Alliance. Here the men are learning to pound the log. Actually, this is Ronnie Bear, our lead drummer, about 10 years ago. And you can see why he's a drummer now instead. The bookmarks were made by Kim Bryant and her daughters, who also picked the grass. In our culture, the whole community makes the basket. So please accept this gift on behalf of our organization and our people. Indigenous basketry is heavily natural resource dependent, and when the environmental balance is upset, the art form and entire way of life is threatened. In Michigan and parts of Ohio, the emerald ash borer, an invasive pest from Asia, is killing all of the ash trees. As the beetle slowly makes its way eastward, our board of directors are moving to document all aspects of the tradition in order to provide future instructions for the next generations, in case we lose all of our trees in Maine. As in all tribes, elders are honored for their knowledge. We have awarded about 150 apprenticeships since 1993. Our nonprofit work has been supported by many: Maine Arts Commission, Fund for Folk Culture, Maine Community Foundation, Seventh Generation Fund, National Endowment for the Arts, and more recently, the Ford Foundation and Link Artography, just to name a few. Clara Neptune Keyser is one of two National Heritage Fellows from Maine, so honored by the National Endowment for the Arts. Her award was in 2002. I love these baskets. The people, especially the Indian woman holding a little basket purse. I don't know if you can see that. This is all ash and sweetgrass. She's selling at one of our annual gatherings and markets in Bar Harbor, Maine. So as you can see, our people still travel to the coast to trade. Next. These are Clara's pieces. The handkerchief basket is on the right is a really old style, dating back to Victorian times, 1800s. I want to note another issue that Native artists continue to face, and that is intellectual property rights. And this is universal. But this summer, the president of design for Longaberger Baskets Company came to Maine to a museum to study our basket weaves and our designs. We fully expect to see our weaves on Longaberger Baskets on the QVC shopping channel sometime in the near future as a result. And I don't believe that there's a lot we can do about this. I guess the point is they won't be Native American baskets and they won't be as good as ours. My great-grandmother was engaged in the creative economy through arts and heritage tourism on Indian Island in Old Town, Maine. So as you can see, I was not the first. This is a picture of her and her baskets on the Penobscot Reservation in the 1940s. I make my baskets on the same wooden forms using tools handed down to me. In fact, I have a couple of styles here that I made, a sweetgrass flat and sewing basket on the same forms dating back into the 1800s. Next. This is four generations in my family on Mother's Day. This is actually the basket maker holding me, the next basket maker in the family. And it really graphically depicts how the art form skipped two generations, my grandmother and mother not becoming basket makers. My mother went to nursing school in Portland, as did many from our reservation. There was nothing glorious about being a Native American artist in the 1950s, and certainly it wasn't advantageous even to be a Native American. I want to impress upon you the history of our basketry commerce. This postcard is also from Indian Island, and this is a picture of my grandmother and some of her siblings and cousins. And the baby on the far right, who's my great aunt, would have turned 91 last week. This is my great grandmother's father-in-law's business card, dating well back into the 1800s. And I wanted you to note the reference to travel to southern New England, to New London, Connecticut, Charlene. So the traveling with the markets for all kinds of things, like Verrazano mentioned, the baskets, the bows, the arrows, the canoes. Five generations later, this is one of my more contemporary pieces. It's corn. And it's a basket, 14 inches long, made of all ash and sweetgrass. In fact, even the husks are ash woven into the cover. I like this pineapple by my former apprentice, Jennifer Neptune. She's now a colleague and manager of the Wabanaki Arts Center Gallery in Old Town. Again, it's all ash with sweetgrass. It's always a good sign when your apprentice makes better baskets than you do. Next. Actually, this summer, Jennifer and I were walking down Beacon Hill outside here on our way to the New England Foundation for the Arts office with our designer sunglasses on, and we were juggling baskets and Dunkin' Donuts coffee walking down the hill. And Jennifer remarked that she had read accounts of our ancestors selling our baskets on Boston Common in the 1800s. So this is a watercolor that was painted in 1845. That she reminded me about. The Maine Indian Basket Makers Alliance is located in Old Town, Maine, on the Penobscot River. Through our Wabanaki Arts Center Gallery, we're selling the work of 100 artisans, mostly basket makers. The gallery stimulates arts making and provides the only year-round retail outlet and therefore income for our tribal baskets and art, native art in Maine. It also helps us to raise some of our own sustainable revenue. At this time of year, our office is full of harvest baskets, or a little bit earlier than now, and it's actually just paths through the baskets to get to the photocopier in the back, so also serves as our office. Next. Last month, we were honored by a visit from the National Endowment for the Arts Chairman Dana Joya on tour with the Maine Arts Commission. Here is accepting a gift from the Maine Indian Basket Makers Alliance, as we give gifts. And it was made by the artist Jeremy Frey, Passamaquoddy. Our board president, who was to give the presentation, urged Jeremy to be the one to present the basket as part of his professional development. So this was a new experience. And he's received a letter since with a big seal and a National Endowment on it. So he's very pleased. The chairman came to see our traditional arts apprenticeship program, which is one of the longest running in the nation. Jeremy's work is here. He's a phenomenal 28-year-old artist, as you can see. This is, again, all ash, showing the porcupine weave, approximately 5 to 6 inches diameter. We hired Jeremy in 2002 out of a tribal drug and alcohol rehab program to help us in a Boys and Girls Club workshop, a basketry workshop on his reservation. 2 weeks ago, he led the teaching of a basketry workshop at Indian Township, the other Passamaquoddy tribe, where two young adults in his tribe had just died of drug overdoses, that in a community of just a few hundred people. In 2003, the National Museum of the American Indian opened the language of Native American basketry from the weaver's view. This exhibit represented the first major basketry exhibition that engaged Native weavers from all over the country as guest curators. And my friend Terrell Duke Johnson, the Tonawatam weaver from Arizona, was commissioned to weave this piece. It's a mosaic tribute to the work of the four major Native American basketry organizations using cedar bark, ash, red willow, bear grass, yucca, La Jolla. It's about the size of a door. The actual cover photo here is part of a magazine article in Native People's Magazine. The nonprofit organizations in California, Maine, Arizona, and the Pacific Northwest, founded in the early to mid-1990s, represent some 2,000 basket weavers working toward preserving their own traditions and paving the way for future weavers. The Northwest Native American Basket Weavers Association, or NABA, works on issues of indigenous healing with plants, access to basketry materials, and annual gatherings of weavers from Washington, Idaho, and Oregon. The Tonawatam Basket Weavers Association honors elder knowledge, shown here harvesting cholla, farming, and basketry. The organization was featured on a 60 Minutes show about food production and diabetes a couple of years ago, which is a big issue in their tribe. This is a California Indian Basket Weavers Association member cooking acorn soup in a traditional basket at their annual gathering. They support teaching programs, materials access, and materials protection as well, working closely with the U.S. Forest Service in California. They use some 200 basketry materials there. They have many and diverse and large state of weavers. So the basketry organizations work holistically and in stewardship with the resources, the culture, and the tribes. Thanks. I want to tell you a story that's been developing among our basketry organizations about a frog as a metaphor for the steady strength of this national grassroots arts movement. A couple of years ago, participants in a Circumpacific gathering at the Longhouse at Evergreen State College in Washington learned to weave frogs made of La Jolla, taught by a native Hawaiian weaver. There, a Haida weaver from Washington wove a frog out of cedar bark. And then she went and traveled to an annual basketry gathering. It's a big one in the country that's held at the Heard Museum in Phoenix, where she then taught a number of weavers, indigenous weavers from all over the nation, to make frogs. A young Passamaquoddy weaver brought his frog home to the reservation at the easternmost point in the continental United States, where he then taught a young friend to make a frog of ash with the little green one on the top there. It's been dyed. We estimate that this magical basket frog, transforming through three different basket materials, spent about 2 years making its way from Hawaii to Maine. When I related this story to my language teacher, she told me a traditional story about a frog in our culture. And the gist of it is that an eagle picks up a frog and flies him around until the Mikumwasis, or the little people, show him where to place this frog in a good and correct environment. It occurred to me that the partners who support Native American arts are like the eagle, and that the four basketry organizations and weavers are like the Mikumwasis, pointing the way to where the work still needs to be done. This story is kind of still developing with the thoughts, and as our baskets always to be woven. I want to shift focus now and talk about some of the other good work that I know that's happening in North America around Native American arts. As Rebecca mentioned, I'm a proud board member of the New England Foundation for the Arts for the past 2 years, and I'm really pleased to be involved in bringing Native artists together here for the first time in New England, the six New England states. We're in the process of building a long overdue Native arts funding program. This Native artist gathering was held at Mashantucket Pequot Tribal Nation Museum in partnership with the tribe and represents almost as many tribes as there are people in that photograph. Ramona Peters, Wampanoag artist, who's here, in the photo, Narragansett artists, Abenaki artists. Also, there are Iroquois and Crow artists in this group. Through this work, we met George Longfish, an Iroquois artist originally from New York. He's a retired UC Davis professor in Native Studies and Art at the seat of Native American activism, UC Davis, and he now lives in Maine, has a gallery in New Hampshire, and is emerging really as a mentor advisor to younger artists. And this is some of the rich value we're seeing in simply bringing these artists together. And I know there'll be so much more to be gained by this. Until recently, William S. Yellowrobe was living in New England. This is a scene from his play, The Grandchildren of the Buffalo Soldiers, a really powerful New England Foundation for the Arts and Ford-supported project. Originating at Trinity Repertory Theater, Rhode Island, with Betsy Theobald Richards Cherokee as artistic director, the play deals with important issues of Native American identity and has traveled widely. Interestingly, these same issues of identity are relevant to art service organizations as we develop guidelines to serve artists. Who is a Native American artist? Who is a Native American? What is Native American art? Do we use the Indian Arts and Crafts Act of 1990? How do we define art in terms of our language and popular culture? What is authentic? Native artists need to be the ones to be engaged in providing these answers. So our organization is working closely with New England Foundation for the Arts in the development of these issues. NIFA is part of the Illumination cohort, as Rebecca mentioned earlier, at the Ford Foundation, which is developing infrastructure and capacity for arts and artists in Indian country nationwide. The National Dance Project at NIFA is a good example of a support system already in place for emerging performance artists that will now serve Native performance artists, like the dancers who traditionally would come with our drum today. Through more outreach and illumination, I believe this will happen. And prior to this, we've had very few good, authentic applications at the National Dance Project for support of Native dance. So really excited about this project, this part of our program. Tim Shea is a contemporary Penobscot artist who was trained in Santa Fe, New Mexico at Institute of American Indian Arts. Last night, I met Della Warrior, who's here today in the audience, and she is a longtime director at that fine arts school in Santa Fe. A number of our people have gone to school there from all over the United States, and I think about six from our tribe. I hope to see arts education infrastructure built here in New England so that someday Native artists can go to a similar art school or at least take art classes from a Native American artist professor. So this is part of the infrastructure that we're talking about building in New England. Next. The Longhouse at Evergreen State College in Washington is a fine example of an illumination project and is providing great support for Native American arts making, teaching, and exhibition. These cedar panels were woven by the late great spiritual leader of the Longhouse, whose name cannot be mentioned yet out of respect. He was also a First Peoples Fund Community Spirit Award recipient and a National Endowment for the Arts Heritage Fellow. So you're beginning to see a connection between the honoring programs that are happening out there in the Native American arts world and the national scene. This is a piece by Preston Singletary, the premier Tlingit glass artist. He was featured in an artist-in-residency program at the Longhouse. This is his glass basket whaling hat, 14-inch diameter. It's a stunning piece, and you can see all the traditional and elements in it. Next. Preston's residency inspired Joe Fetterson, a Colville basket weaver and fine artist who's also a professor of Native Studies at the Longhouse, to make this fish trap of glass. So the conical shape of the ancient fish trap, traditionally made of basketry materials where the fish swims in but not out, is revealed here in this piece. And actually, that's a universal basket all around the world in indigenous cultures. I find this point of a younger artist teaching a senior artist professor to make baskets in a contemporary arts medium extremely compelling and inspiring. Dolores Churchill Zahida Weaver from Washington. She's a 2006 National Endowment for the Arts Heritage Fellow, and she was also first honored with the Community Spirit Award a couple of years ago by the First Peoples Fund. I think this year at the NEA, three of the 11 National Heritage Fellows were Indigenous people. In true community spirit, she gathers materials, makes and teaches art, dances in her regalia, in her community, everything really. So inspired by these elders. The validation of Native American basket weavers by First Peoples Fund and the NEA over the past decade, as well as by a number of state arts agencies, including our own in Maine, has brought long overdue national recognition to these artists and elevated the art form to where it belongs among the finest artistic traditions in our nation. Another First Peoples Fund Community Spirit Award recipient, Pat Courtney Gold of Wasco Nation in Oregon, was honored for a deep insight and community spirit, speaking to the world really in this sturgeon basket about the aberrant sturgeon in the Columbia River near the Hanford, Washington nuclear waste site. You can see the radioactive fish at the bottom. She made this piece to commemorate the Lewis and Clark expedition, another creative economy example of 1805. She wove this in honor of the weaver who made the original basket collected by Lewis and Clark that's now at the Harvard Peabody Museum. The Santa Fe Indian Market is the premier Indian arts marketing event in the world, with 1,000 artists and 100,000 market goers in attendance. This is the winner of first place in the diverse art forums, and you really can't see it up close. It's by Rhonda Holybear, a Plains artist. But most of the work on those dolls is beaded, small glass beads. The cup will come as no surprise to those who know the director of the First Peoples Fund. The other major Indian markets are at Heard Museum and Idlejord Museum. This is Terrell Dew Johnson, a Tona Otham weaver from Sells, Arizona. His gourd is woven with bear grass after it's been bronzed in an old foundry in New York City. He told me at Indian Market that they still don't know what to do with his baskets in a judging sense. In all seriousness, the classifications and categories there at most Indian markets are in need of Native artist input. For example, at Santa Fe, baskets are judged in the textile classification alongside room-size Navajo rugs, which actually took best of show this year. Oftentimes, weaving terms used by markets and museums in exhibitions are not the same as the ones we, the artists, use. In fact, to us in Maine, our birch bark canoe is a big basket. On our recent field trip to New Mexico, some of us visited Pueblo artist Roxanne Swensel's new gallery. She asked her tribal governor to use the tower at the Pojaki Pueblo, part of the Poe Arts Center, as her own arts gallery. It's a five-story tower, and it now holds a retrospective of all of her work right in her tribal community. I think this is a great model that's artist-centered and artist-driven and brings art collectors from all over the world to contribute to the reservation economy. I hope to see more tribes partner with our own artists in these kinds of professional collaborations. And I think this will happen. You know, it's in contrast to kind of the older model of the gift shop within the museum, the tribal museum or the tribal casino. We also visited with Native American actor Gary Farmer and his new art gallery on the plaza in Santa Fe. He is an actor in a number of parts in Smoke Signals and some other well-known movies. And so it's great to see a Native American artist with a gallery. Marvin Oliver is Quinault in Pueblo, and he's a professor at the University of Washington. He also taught a class at Maine, actually, partially in person and partially by satellite. So we do have some classes up there. He won first in the sculpture division, not with this piece, but with another at Santa Fe. And again, with 1,000 artists, it's a feat, an accomplishment. This Salish glass basket is approximately 3.5 feet high. He said, "My works are formulated by merging the spirit of past traditions with those of the present to create new horizons for the future." Marvin and other successful Native American artists are now beginning to talk about philanthropy through investment of their own resources in youth artisans. I think this focus on the next generation of artists by Native American artists is the uniquely Native aspect. It's very powerful and timely. R. Carlos Nakai, Ute Dine, is a renowned flute musician that probably everybody has heard of. He's among a growing number of successful musicians and composers sharing with the next generation. Here, he's featured with the Chickasaw composer through the good work of First Nations Composers Initiative of the American Composers Forum in St. Paul at a National Museum of American Indian Native Music series. This is also, Fancy is also an Illumination partner with a strong national presence. And we can tell I'm really proud of the work of all these colleagues. Next. This is R.J. Joseph, a Cree filmmaker, at the Smithsonian Folklife Festival in Washington, D.C. this summer with Kellogg Youth Fellows. This event with 80 indigenous basket weavers at the center of Smithsonian Folklife Festival was organized by Michigan State University. Native American weavers from all over North America were featured at the festival on the mall. And a special youth Kellogg component went behind the scenes to learn professional skills, new technology, see the inner workings of National Museum of American Indian and Smithsonian. Five weavers from Maine were featured at the festival, as were weavers from all across, and including Roberta Uno's uncle from Hawaii, who's a hat weaver. Many of you know Roberta at the Ford Foundation. This is Tia. Thank you, Tia. The Seventh Generation Fund is unique in supporting the human element in indigenous culture and art. For 30 years, they've honored the spirit of joy in arts making and supported grassroots empowerment and sovereignty all across the Americas. They're also an Illumination project. In conclusion, whether we're seeing a first basket at Tona Otham in Arizona, a fashion show at Coeur d'Alene in Idaho, a fish trap demonstration at Hoopa in California, or a first basket in Passamaquoddy at Maine, the great significance of this work is very evident, I think, to our people. As Native American artists, we always celebrate where we have been. This is a Penobscot boy sometime in the early 1900s at our reservation on the landing in Old Town. We still make these baskets at Indian Island. We still honor these traditions. And we celebrate where we're going. This painting with a basket at its center was created by another Penobscot boy, Seneca Love, age 13, who won a National Indian Education Art Award with that painting this summer. So I want to thank my colleagues for sharing some of these really special images, and thank you all for your attention.